The philosopher Santayana said, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it in the future. Following is something from the past we certainly do not want to repeat in the future. During the time of Joseph Stalin's great hullabaloo, his government starved 7 million people to death. This piece of history leads us to ask, did Stalin's government starve 7 million people to death by accident of policy or by an act of willful intent?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 944th edition of a Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in San Blas who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
So what do you think? Accident of policy or willful intent?
Willful intent.
Willful intent, he says. We'll see what the rest of us thinks here in a moment. Producer Kelly Bayer is also with us out there. Folks, in 1932 and 1933, approximately 7 million Ukrainians and Cossacks were starved to death in the breadbasket of the Soviet Union by the central government of Joseph Stalin. Some scholars suggest this Holodomor, H-O-L-O-D-O-M-O-R, which may be translated as extermination by hunger, was an accident of policy. It was, after all, the time in which Stalin's central government was going about the countryside, taking private farms and turning them into collective farms. The resulting economic chaos, the theory goes, was substantial enough to cause the deaths. Other scholars suggest the Holodomor, I might get that word right, Holodomor was an act of willful intent. This argument points to the reluctance of the Ukrainian people in giving their farms and homes to Stalin's central government. This argument suggests that the collectivization of private agriculture was an omelet requiring the breaking of many eggs, and thus the killings were certainly an act of willful intent. The history of Stalin's great Holodomor leads us to ask, how did Stalin's central government take control of Ukraine's food? How did government manage to withhold the food from the people who grew the food? And was the starving to death of 7 million Ukrainians and Cossacks an accident of government policy, or was it a willful act of government intent? Here to help us explore this sad piece of human history, we have Columbia Professor Walter Zarycki, who is the director of the Center for U.S.-Ukrainian Relations. Professor Zarycki, thank you for joining us on the Food Chain today.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I'm very grateful that you invited me on. Just wanted to straighten out that that I've done my doctoral work at Columbia, but I taught at NYU for about 30 years, and now I'm director of the Center for U.S.-Ukrainian Relations.
Okay, good. We're straightened out then. Right. Well, this Holodomor is something I didn't even know there was a name for it, but I've always been kind of interested in that piece of history because my great-grandparents, who were German farmers in the Ukraine, were booted out by the Ukrainians. And after looking at this story that we're doing today, it occurs to me that my great-grandparents were probably pretty lucky to get kicked out. Would that be true?
In fact, in some ways, and if only the Ukrainians had the power to have kicked anybody out. Ukraine actually has the breadbasket of, and Ukrainians have lived in a strange relationship with their northern neighbors, the Russians, for nearly 300 years. Ukraine has been the breadbasket for centuries. And in some ways, the Ukrainians were not able to control their lands during the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, because when the Cossack Zaporizhia fell in 1775 to Catherine. From that point on, they essentially fell under the Tsarist Empire. Mm-hmm. Now, the Tsarist Empire is interesting, if I could just be continue.
Sure, please.
The Tsarist Empire was interesting in that it did want to exploit the Ukrainian lands, and we're not too happy about the indigenous population, where the Ukrainians are eventually in what is now called Southern Russia, Cossacks. But they continue to exploit those. They continue to try to do a process of Russification. They didn't just try to Russify the Ukrainians. They also tried to Russify the Germans, especially the Maimonite colonies that were on Ukrainian soil that were extremely industrious. They also carried on anti-Semitic pogroms during the 18th and 19th century on Ukrainian lands, which eventually the Ukrainians were blamed for. But in effect, man, the Ukrainians never had control of that territory, of their own territory, during that period of time. Mm-hmm. Eventually, what happened is that the Russification process didn't seem to work all that well, because the Ukrainians actually broke loose in 1917, 1918, as did other nationalities.
And this was the time. This was the time of Stalin's the Bolsheviks taking over Russia, right?
Right. In an interesting case of that in that first stage, it's almost like the Ukrainians know that there are two stages in Russia history that could have been critical. Kerensky, when he first started the first revolution, that's February before the Bolshevik Revolution, for 5 or 6 months there was a democratic regime in Russia, or what might be passed for a democratic regime. And during that time, the Ukrainians actually managed to break away. Then the Bolsheviks came to power, and they actually were arguing, this is interesting, the Russian Bolsheviks were arguing to the Ukrainian the Ukrainians and the other nationalities, we will change all of this, both on the nationalities question and on the social question, because they were promising bread, land, freedom, and so on and so forth. But ironically, when the Bolsheviks came, they exacerbated the situation, because whereas the Russians were simply pressing the Ukrainians in a national war, the Bolsheviks then took it one step further. They promised freedom, apparently said that, that imperialism is the highest stage only of capitalism. In fact, imperialism has been around in the feudal societies and slave-owning societies, but that was their Marxist mistake. But the fact is, then, that they kept insisting that they were going to make it better for the peasants. In effect, what they did is made it much worse for the Ukrainian peasants, because they declared a class war. Now, interesting, because of the geography, the Ukrainians find themselves in what is essentially northern the United States, where essentially where the northern United States and southern Canada are. That land is some of the most fertile land in the world. It's called Chernozem, or Black Earth. I actually have traveled to southern Canada and northern United States and have seen that we actually have some of that. We also have Black Earth. But can you imagine the entire country filled with Black Earth?
Mm-hmm. Was extremely
fertile. So any peasant, if he got himself any land, and especially after Lenin created the new economic program and peasants were able to get some land back, the fact is that anyone who had any land would become a rich peasant in Ukraine. And so, in effect, what we ended up having is a situation in which, during Tsarist Russia, you actually had, it was basically taking it from the Ukrainians as a nation. But eventually, when you got to the 20s, it wasn't in the late 20s when Stalin decided, man, that the collectivization had to be complete. They declared war on essentially the Ukrainian peasant. And so,
Because they were independent, and because they were independent, and because they were well-to-do, and because they took care of themselves, and there was no controlling them.
Yes, and there was no controlling them in some ways, but in effect, and that's why the father of the term genocide, Lemkin, actually used the Ukrainian genocide as an example in 1953, and he actually said, it's interesting how they proceeded, the Bolsheviks. They proceeded first then because they continued the national war, and they therefore in 1929 went after the intelligentsia. In 1930 they went after the churches, which was the heart and soul of the Ukrainian nation. Then in 1931, they went after the rich peasants and deported many of them into Siberia. Others that resisted, they eliminated. But by 1932-33, and this is what everybody has to remember, it was no longer the rich peasants they were coming after, the kulak, what they call, or kulaks. They were coming after the entire peasantry of Ukraine, the middle and poor peasants. Anybody who had, you know, 3 cows and a hectare of land, a couple of acres of land.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Professor Zarecki, right. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. When we come back, the Holodomor, we're going to talk about how Joseph Stalin's central government starved 7 million Ukrainians to death, took their food right out of their mouths, prevented them from eating it. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, Walter Zarecki, and you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Remember the Holodomor. In 1932-33, the central government of Joseph Stalin starved 7 million Ukrainians to death. But hey, did that really happen? Listen to this from the New York Times under the byline of Walter Duranty of that period. Any report of famine in Russia today is an exaggeration or malignant propaganda. And at the same time, in 1933, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt was doing whatever he could to normalize relationship with the Soviet Union and to establish trade relationships with that new government. So it didn't seem like we even knew about the Holodomor until the 1980s. Did it really happen, Walter Zarecki? And if so, how was it hidden, kept hidden for so long?
Well, that's a two-part question, and probably I can answer the first and probably can answer the second because we've done a major conference the last 2 weeks ago at the Princeton University Club here in New York, and we've managed to get 60 of the best folks on Holodomor studies and genocide studies you can get. And the mechanism was insidious and essentially started with the grain growing areas, but eventually affected just about all of Ukraine, including urban Ukraine. We discovered that what the Stalin and his henchmen organized are what are known as 25,000ers. These were people that would come to the villages and would demand from the villages just about all the food at the beginning, just about all the food that was available. About all the grain that was available.
Back up just a minute, Professor, because this doesn't make sense that you could just get a bunch of thugs and send them into a village. There had to be significant amount of preparation for something like that to happen. I can't.
The funny part is that I was about to say the reason why we now know that this happened is that the archives, especially since the democratic regime, the Orange government of Ukraine came to power in 2006. It may have lasted only until 2010, but it did open up the archives, essentially the KGB archives that were left in Ukraine after Ukraine declared independence in 91. with these new archives and with also the new archives that have been opened and the experts that we heard at the Princeton Club, essentially from Poland, have also opened up their archives. They seem to suggest, all the archives now seem to suggest, something we didn't have access to either in the 30s, 40s, or for that even matter, in the 80s, when, in fact, people did start, a U.S. Famine Commission was established in the 80s under President Reagan to look at this issue. At that time, they didn't have those archives. We now have the archives, and we now have the orders of Stalin, Kaganovich, Kostashev, Kostya. We have dead on right what they were planning to do.
Did the government of Stalin have such tight control over the press, and in fact the Western press as well, I guess, that none of this got out? I mean, 7 million people dying.
The Russians in the old days, when in Tsarist Russia, men used to create Potemkin villages for the Tsar, and Stalin basically picked up in the Soviet period, picked up the same situation. I mean, he invited Western diplomats to areas that he thought were in decent shape. He actually invited them to Russia, and ironically, that's what the Ukrainians have been trying to say for all this time. That in Russia, you didn't have the starvation. You didn't have the starvation in the big factory areas because those were being fed. They were being fed by the Ukrainian grain. That's why this is actually Holodomor, because it wasn't that there was actually a lack of grain. The lack of grain was not there. The grain was sent to other parts of the Soviet Union to feed other nationalities, including and obviously feed the Kremlin.
So they took the food from the people who grew it and gave it to other people in the city and sold a bunch of it.
It gets worse because we now have identified the last 10 years since a seminal conference that we ran at Columbia University. When you mentioned Columbia University, I ran it with my friend Mark von Hagen 10 years ago. We actually had, it was proof of pudding was that that grain was being shipped out of Odessa at the time in 32-33, and we actually have proof of that because the Canadian grain growers were looking at what was happening in Ukraine and discovered, man, that the Ukrainians that grains were still being shipped out of Ukraine. Stalin was still making money on Ukrainian grain while the Ukrainian countryside was being devastated.
So he was essentially starving the farmers to death who were growing the grains, and using it to feed the factory workers and selling it offshore. You know, that he could pull something like off is totally mind-boggling. You mentioned the steps that they took in pacifying the country. Would you go through those steps again for us?
Well, it's actually Lemkin does it. He says that there was a four-pronged, in his famous speech in 53, he says there's a four-pronged attack on the Ukrainian nation. The first blow is aimed at the intelligentsia, the national brain. Then the second blow is against the churches, the priests, the hierarchy, the soul of Ukraine. The third prong of the Soviet plan was aimed at the farmers, the large mass of independent peasants who were the repository of tradition, folklore, music, the national language, the literature, the national spirit of Ukraine. The weapon used against this body is perhaps the most terrible. That was starvation. And in effect, then, the fourth step was actually the fragmentation of the Ukrainian people, because what they did is, once the Ukrainian, this is a case of ethnic cleansing as well. Not only were the Ukrainians killed, but in the years that followed, between 33 and 39, what you essentially had is people from other parts of the Soviet Union, not necessarily just Russians, but Russians, Belarusians, folks on the Volga of various nationalities that were brought onto Ukrainian territory because someone had to grow the grain again.
Right.
Someone had to work the factories again. Someone had to work in the Donbas coal mines, which was all the energy production. At that time, Russia in the north didn't have Kuzbass. They essentially had Donbas. And so all the coal was coming out of that area. And in effect, someone had to work that. And what they did is they brought in folks then who essentially ended up without a nationality. They weren't neither Russian nor Ukrainian nor Belarusian nor Vulgar German nor Vulgar Bulgar nor Jewish and so on and so forth. They were just essentially what we call the Soviet man. They were trying to remake it in their mindless image and stuff like that.
So then the first thing they did was they got rid of the national Weltanschauung, the national intelligentsia, the spirit right. of the country, the intellectual spirit. Right. This is what we are. Right. The second thing they right. did was they went in and got rid of the church, which was the glue that held everything together. Then they went in and they took out the farmers,
right?
Which left not much at all. And so then
not much at all, because of the first set of farmers were taken by collectivization and were deported to Siberia. The second part were just simply starved to death. And it's interesting that in this class war, it's the poor, the middle and the poor, that actually suffered more than the rich did, because the rich were simply deported. The poor, the middle and the poor, and that's something, that's a classic case for modern times, for the 21st century. That often men with these sort of class war attitudes and so on and so forth, what you end up having is the middle and the poor suffering most. And I don't want to get into details on it, but I think people ought to understand that.
Yeah, when we come back, I want to talk about the 25,000ers and how Stalin's thugs went into the villages and kept the food away from the people who grew the food. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Walter Zurycki, and you right back. Do stay tuned for the Holodomor and you. Well, here's a piece of history that we certainly don't want to see repeated. In the 1932 and 1933, the government of Joseph Stalin destroyed the lives of 7 million people by starving them to death. How did he do that? Well, first thing they did is they went into the Ukraine and attacked the Ukrainians' reason for being, their intellectual software that holds a country together. They got rid of the churches. They got rid of the farmers. And then they fragmented the community into smithereens with the 25,000ers, which were Joseph Stalin's shock troops. Tell us a little bit about who these people were, Professor Zurycki.
Yeah, it's interesting because when the Communist Party functionaries at the lower level, usually recruited, and everybody's known that, but the Cheka had earlier been recruited from what was known as the Lumpen proletariat. That's essentially a criminal element of the old Tsarist regime. These folks, when they went in, they had orders first to take the grain, and when the grain was not sufficient, at first the grain was, they thought, was sufficient to break the back of the peasant. But the peasant, there was just enough in terms of seed for the following year that the folks were still feeding themselves. There were enough cows. There were enough, in fact, cats and dogs.
Which is the nature of farmers, right?
Right, which is the nature of farmers. That there was food out there. There was some folks, you know, grew their own little stock of potatoes and so on, and vegetables. The ironic part is that in the first stages, it was simply the grain that was being requisitioned, and up to 75%, and then up to 85%, and eventually just the entire stock.
They took all the grain?
All of it. And then eventually they also, as we now have the reports, by June, July of 1933, they were taking seed for next year's growing. In which case, man, we now understand that seed could be used by others in 34, as long as they knew that they could break the back of the Ukrainian peasant in 33. So they took first the grain, then they took the seed, then they eventually took, and that's why livestock disappeared. They eventually took the cows and the pigs, and eventually, meaning what was said by October of 33, and you can hear it from Polish consular people that were traveling in the area, that and the new archives that have opened up, You can hear it from the Italian consular people. You even in the 32, everybody is talking about the Germans eventually later on, that the Nazi regime came in 33 and so on. But in already in November of 32, when Germany was still under Weimar regime, you had reports by German diplomats that have talked about this, that what was going on. But by July of 33, let me get back to that period, you're talking about July, August, September, October of 33, essentially just about everything, that was edible was gone. Just about anything. I mean, the pets were gone. Entire villages, essentially, people actually, and this is the saddest thing I've ever heard, sometimes Soviet Desinform would talk about cannibalism and so on, but it wasn't just Soviet Desinform. People actually desperate enough to revert to cannibalism.
How did the party force this onto the peasants? I mean, didn't the peasants rise up and revolt?
Well, we now have, that's the funny part is, we now have a shocking example of that, why it was so important and why the Soviet Union and even the early new Russian Federation governments, in fact, I think Putin has basically closed down whatever reference. In fact, someday we would want to ask President Putin to open up all the rest of the archives. But we now have it clear that everybody was aware of what was going on. That by October and November of 33, the party apparat knew that they had decimated, and there seems to be no remorse there by anyone. In fact, Kosar is essentially celebrating at some point that we've broken the back of Ukrainian nationalism. And so, and there was no way at this very moment, you mentioned that, at this very moment, the West, especially the United States, Britain and France had already done their deed in the 20s by recognizing the Soviet Union. But President Roosevelt was recognizing the Soviet Union at that very moment. So you can imagine that the West wasn't all that interested in hearing that 7 million Ukrainians had just expired.
Well, yeah, the New York Times said it was all just malicious propaganda, that nothing was like that was could possibly happen in this new form of government, and we seemed to be cheerleading. I don't know.
Well, what's funny is because this has been around for 10 years, and it ought to be repeated because we had it unveiled at our Columbia University conference 10 years ago. On Holodomor, on the 70th anniversary. Leonard Leshchuk, a very interesting character, wrote a very important book on U.S. intelligence operations in the 20s and 30s. And he looked into the archival stuff. We obviously didn't have a central intelligence agency at the time. We had the Office of Naval Intelligence on, but the State Department had its own sort of informal intelligence service. And we know for a fact that Clayford, one of the big State Department spokesmen in Eastern Europe, reports in 1931 to the State Department. It's known as the Gordon Dispatch, and an asset everybody ought to know about it. The Gordon Dispatch, we have a copy of it if you need it, Mr. Olson. The Gordon Dispatch says, and I quote, that that Mr. Clayford has talked to Mr. Durante, and Mr. Durante has told him that he does not print anything, or he does not write anything, without the approval of the Soviet government.
And this was the New York Times.
This is the New York Times. Yes, in fact, if I had that, I could probably read it for you, because I got it. I think I've got it right in front of me.
And that was something that was Walter Durante himself saying that the writer for the New York Times is saying.
Clayford is signed under this. I've got the three-page document. In conclusion, Durante pointed out that in agreement with the New York Times and the Soviet authorities, his official dispatches always reflect the official opinion of the Soviet regime and not his own. And this is Clayford and it's a memorandum, June 4th, 1931. And on the front page, we've got Embassy of the United States of America, Berlin, June 4th, 1931. The Honorable State Secretary of State, Washington, sir, as a possible interest to the department, I have the honor to enclose here a memorandum containing the substance of a conversation between Durant, Moscow correspondents of the New York Times, and a member of our embassy concerning Soviet Russia.
So here we have a situation where Joseph Stalin is starving 7 million people to death. And we have our own government recognizing him and establishing trade with him. And we have our own press agreeing never to say a discouraging word. And for seven million people.
We end up giving Durante. We end up giving Durante a Pulitzer Prize.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Walter Zurycki, the Holodomor. Oh my goodness! Right back. Well, here's the question on the table today. Was the starving to death of 7 million Ukrainians and Cossacks an accident of government policy, or was it a willful act of government intent? Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking with Professor Walter Zurycki. He is the director of the Center for U.S.-Ukrainian Relations. And I guess that's a one heck of a question to be asking. Could it be possible that the government would deliberately destroy 7 million of its own citizens? Professor Zurycki, when you do an internet search of the Holodomor, you come up with essentially two different kinds of websites, one that says it was an accident of policy and the other that says it was an act of willful intent. Who thinks, really, that it was an accident of policy?
My suspicion is that there are two types.
Besides the New York Times.
Besides those that might worry, that my attitude is that there are those that still might worry that if they denied the famine in 1933, and it turns out that the world declares that the Ukrainian famine was in fact genocide, that these folksmen might end up having to be might have the stain, additional stain of being Stalinist collaborators. Our collaborators with a genocidal maniac like Stalin. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's that fear. There's that element that at some point you would have to say that if the Nazis rightfully were condemned and Nazi parties have been rightfully not allowed to exist in Western civilization, in Western nations, in the Euro-Atlantic community, that you might have to come to the same conclusion when it comes to communist ideology. The communist ideology was equally genocidal, and actually at a moment of equal genocide. But the funny part is that there is a second group that would, they don't sort of deny it, they just sort of would like to downplay it. They would like to wash it of its genocidal intent. And the thing is that they forget what Raphael Lemkin, who invented the word genocide and used the Ukrainian example, he said, these are the chief steps in the systematic destruction of the Ukrainian nation in its progressive absorption within the new Soviet nation. Notably, there was no attempt at the complete annihilation, such as the methods of the German attack on the Jews. And yet, if the Soviet program had succeeded completely, if the intelligentsia of the priests and the peasants could be eliminated, Ukraine would be as dead as if every Ukrainian was killed, for it had lost that part of it that it kept and developed its cultures, its beliefs, its common ideas, which guided it and gave it its soul, which in short made it a nation rather than a mass of people. And so in effect he says, therefore I conclude this was an act of genocide, the geno. They wanted to break the back of the Ukrainian folks because these were the breadbasket folks, and at some point, even on the left, there are folksmen that are getting to the idea of what the French did to the Algerians, at some point wanted the territory but didn't want the indigenous population, the Bedouin population. But yeah. Someone wanted the Ukrainian territory and our food, but they didn't want us there because we were too independent. We were
when you grow your own food, when you're the person that's producing the food, you're the person in control. So
you're absolutely right.
So if the government wants to get control, they have to take away your right, your ability to grow the food. And that essentially meant the entire Ukrainian culture, as well as its people.
In some ways, then the Ukrainians, actually, that's why I'm delighted to be the head of the director of the U.S.-Ukrainian Relations Center, because the U.S., in some way, the American farmer, is the only one besides the Ukrainian peasant that I can think of. The American farmer is actually the repository. There are less of those than should be. But the American farmer is the repository of our entire memory. The free American farmer and artisan, the small business type, are the basis of what America is. It's what makes America that classic democracy.
And if you want to get rid of America, first thing you do is you start with the American spirit, and then you get rid of its churches, and then you go after its farmers.
Right.
That's the technique by which Stalin went after the. Now, does anybody think that this was just an accident of policy?
They don't. I mean, they've no longer because of the archives out of Poland and that have opened up. They're very especially thankful. The Pilsudski government was very, very good at. I mean, if Pilsudski's intelligence services in the 20s managed to notice that that the Soviets didn't have an opposition and busted up the trust, and also managed to steal the Enigma from the Germans in the late 30s. The Polish intelligence services, men were quite good.
The evidence.
We now have archival. Even Poland's archives, and during when Poland was in the Soviet bloc, were inaccessible. But we now have archives all over the place.
Well, Professor Zuricki, going to have to take a quick break here, but when we come back, I want to ask you about what Santayana suggested, that those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it in the future. Can it happen again? It did, to a much greater extent, right back. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it in the future. What happened in the past, 1932-1933, was that Joseph Stalin found that he could not control the people of the Ukraine. They were farmers. They could take care of themselves, and they did. And they grew the grain that fed the nation. So what he did, of course, was he starved them to death. He took the food right out of their mouth and forbade them to eat it and starved them to death, 7 million of them. And so we look at this and think, my goodness, it could not happen again. But it did just a decade or so down the line in China, when another great helmsman, Mao Zedong, had another great famine. And this time, though, he didn't mess around with a mere 7 million. He starved somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 million people to death. And so we look at this and see how we did forget the past, and it did repeat itself. And so, Professor Zuricki, can it happen again?
Well, actually, and after China, we could say in the 80s, the Ukrainians were worried about what was happening in Cambodia, but Cambodia might not have used famine, but Ethiopia. Mengistu, the Marxist colonel who was running Ethiopia in the 80s, he was using famine as a weapon as well. And in fact, he did it both on a class level and on a national level, because ask the Eritreans. The Eritreans suffered enormous loss in the late 80s from that weapon. Yes, that weapon has been used. It can be used again. The Ukrainians themselves are fearful not only fearful of food as a weapon, but we're fearful of energy as a weapon. The Russians, with their gas wars that they've been using, especially against the Democratic regime in 2005, Yushchenko's regime in 2005 to 10, they were constantly threatening to shut off the gas. And cold can kill in the thousands in the same way as a lack of food.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in the 21st century, food, energy, water, they can be used as weapons, and this is terrible. I mean, it's
what do we as people look out for in governments running amok, as they tend to do? What do we watch out for?
We have to make certain that the basis for a free society. And it's interesting that we should say that in the 21st century, but the basis for a free society is the independent farmer and the small businessman. That's where all the creation of wealth happens. It doesn't happen at the bottom. It doesn't happen at the top. It happens right where with that individual who has the initiative to make either the land grow or the small store go or the small factory go. Or the kid who looks at the internet and discovers the next Facebook. Or the little rocketeer who sends another rocket up into space, but this time on private money, and actually starts establishing that Jetsons future that we always were promised in the 60s. So that's what we need. And I'm not sure that any government can possibly give us that. Any government.
Professor Walter Zarycki, the director of the U.S.-Ukrainian relations. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and telling us the incredible story of Stalin's Holodomor. What a frightening, frightening thing. And tune in next week because it's Mao's Great Famine. And we'll see what parallels, if any, there were between Stalin's Holodomor and Mao's Holodomor. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, I want to encourage you all to remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.